Tour 6, Battle of Ticonderoga. In 1758, the English commanders, incensed at the loss of Fort William Henry, resolved to retaliate by a strong effort to seize Ticonderoga. In June, the combined British and provincial force destined for the expedition was gathered at the head of Lake George under General Abercrombie, while the Marquis de Montcalm lay around the walls of the French stronghold with an army not one-fourth so numerous. Montcalm hesitated whether he should not fall back to Crown Point. It was but a choice of difficulties, and he stayed at Ticonderoga. His troops were disposed, as they had been in the summer before, one battalion, that of Berry, being left near the fort, while the main body, under Montcalm himself, was encamped by the sawmill at the falls, and the rest, under Bourlamac, occupied the head of the portage, with a small advanced force at the landing place in Lake George. It remained to determine at which of these points he should concentrate them and make his stand against the English. Ruin threatened him in any case. Each position had its fatal weakness or its peculiar danger, and his best hope was in the ignorance or blundering of his enemy. He seems to have been several days in a state of indecision. In the afternoon of the 5th of July, the partisan Langy, who had gone out to reconnoiter towards the head of Lake George, came back in haste with the report that the English were embarked in great force. Montcalm sent a canoe down Lake Champlain to assist and Levi's to his aid, and ordered the battalion of Berry to begin a breastwork and a battise in the high ground in front of the fort. That they were not begun before shows that he was in doubt as to his plan of defense, and that his whole army was not now set to work at them shows that his doubt was still unsolved. It was nearly a month since Abercrombie had begun his camp at the head of Lake George. Here, in the ground, where Johnson had beaten Disco, where Montcalm had planted his batteries, and Monroe vainly defended the wooden ramparts of Fort William Henry, were now assembled more than 15,000 men, and the shores, the foot of the mountains, and the broken plains between them were studded thick with tents. Of regulars there were 6,367, officers and soldiers, and of provincials 9,034. To the New England levies, or at least to their chaplains, the expedition seemed a crusade against the abomination of Babylon, and they discoursed in their sermons of Moses sending forth Joshua against Amalek. Abercrombie, raised to his place by political influence, was little but a nominal commander. A heavy man, said Wolfe in a letter to his father, an aged gentleman, infirm in body and mind, wrote William Parkman, a boy of 17, who carried a musket in a Massachusetts regiment, and kept in his knapsack a dingy little notebook, in which he jotted down what passed each day. The age of the aged gentleman was 52. Pitt meant that the actual command of the army should be in the hands of Brigadier Lord Howe, and he was in fact its real chief, the noblest Englishman that has appeared in my time, and the best soldier in the British army, says Wolfe. And he elsewhere speaks of him as that great man. Abercrombie testifies to the universal respect and love with which officers and men regarded him, and Pitt calls him a character of ancient times, a complete model of military virtue. Aye, as this praise is, it seems to have been deserved. The young nobleman, who was then in his 34th year, had the qualities of a leader of men. The army felt him, from general to drummer boy. He was its soul, and while breathing into it his own energy and ardor, and bracing it by stringent discipline, he broke through the traditions of the service and gave it new shapes to suit the time and place. During the past year he had studied the art of forest warfare, and joined Rogers and his Rangers in their scouting parties, sharing all their hardships and making himself one of them. Perhaps the reforms that he introduced were fruits of this rough self-imposed schooling. He made officers and men throw off all useless encumbrances, cut their hair close, wear leggings to protect them from briars, brown the barrels of their muskets, and carry in their knapsacks 30 pounds of meal, which they cooked for themselves, so that, according to an admiring Frenchman, they could live a month without their supply trains. "You would laugh to see the droll figure we all make," writes an officer. "Regulars as well as provincials have cut their coats so as scarcely to reach their waists. No officer or private is allowed to carry more than one blanket and a bearskin. A small portmanteau is allowed each officer. No women follow the camp to wash our linen. Lord Howe has already shown an example by going to the brook and washing his own." Quote, "Here, as in all things, he shared the lot of the soldier, and required his officers to share it. A story is told of him that, before the army embarked, he invited some of them to dinner in his tent, where they found no seats but logs, and no carpet but bearskins. A servant presently placed on the ground a large dish of pork and peas, in which his lordship took from his pocket a sheath containing a knife and fork and began to cut the meat. The guests looked on in some embarrassment, upon which he said, 'Is it possible, gentlemen, that you have come on this campaign without providing yourselves with what is necessary?' And he gave each of them a sheath, with a knife and fork, like his own. Yet this Lycurgus of the camp, as a contemporary calls him, is described as a man of social accomplishments rare even in his rank. He made himself greatly beloved by the provincial officers, with many of whom he was on terms of intimacy, and he did what he could to break down the barriers between the colonial soldiers and the British regulars. When he was at Albany, sharing with other high officers the kindly hospitalities of Mrs. Schuyler, he so won the heart of that excellent matron that she loved him like a son, and, though not given to such effusion, embraced him with tears on the morning when he left her to lead his division to the lake. In Westminster Abbey may be seen the tablet in which Massachusetts pays grateful tribute to his virtues, and commemorates the affection her officers and soldiers bore to his command. In the evening of the 4th of July, baggage, stores, and ammunition were all on board the boats, and the whole army embarked on the morning of the 5th. The arrangements were perfect. Each corps marched without confusion to its appointed station on the beach, and the sun was scarcely above the ridge of French Mountain when all were afloat. A spectator watching them from the shore says that, when the fleet was 3 miles in its way, the surface of the lake at that distance was completely hidden from sight. There were 900 bateaux, 135 whaleboats, and a large number of heavy flat boats carrying the artillery. The whole advanced in 3 divisions, the regulars in the center, and the provincials in the flanks. Each corps had its flags and its music. The day was fair, and many officers were in the highest spirits. Before 10 o'clock they began to enter the narrows, and the boats of the 3 divisions extended themselves into long files, as the mountains closed in either hand upon the contracted lake. From front to rear the line was 6 miles long. The spectacle was superb, the brightness of the summer day, the romantic beauty of the scenery, the sheen and sparkle of those crystal waters, the countless islets, tufted with pine, birch, and fir, the bordering mountains, with their green summits and sunny crags, the flash of oars and glitter of weapons, the banners, the varied uniforms, and the notes of bugle, trumpet, bagpipe, and drum, answered and prolonged by 100 woodland echoes. I never beheld so delightful a prospect, wrote the wounded officer in Albany a fortnight after. Rogers with the Rangers, and Gage with the light infantry, led the way in whaleboats, followed by Bradstreet with his corps of boatmen, armed and drilled, as soldiers. Then came the main body. The central column of regulars was commanded by Lord Howe, his own regiment, the 55th, in the van, followed by the Royal Americans, the 27th, 44th, 46th, and 80th Infantry, and the Highlanders of the 42nd, with their major, Duncan Campbell of Inverawe, silent and gloomy amid the general cheer, for his soul was dark with foreshadowings of death. With the central column came what are described as two floating castles, which were no doubt batteries to cover the landing of the troops. In the right hand and the left were the provincials, uniformed in blue, regiment after regiment, from Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, and Rhode Island. Behind them all came the bateaux, loaded with stores and baggage, and the heavy flat boats that carried the artillery, while a rear guard of provincials and regulars closed the long procession. At 5 in the afternoon they reached Sabbath Day Point, 25 miles down the lake, where they stopped till late in the evening, waiting for the baggage and artillery, which had lagged behind, and here Lord Howe, lying on a bearskin by the side of the Ranger, John Stark, questioned him as to the position of Ticonderoga and its best points of approach. At about 11 o'clock they set out again, and at daybreak entered what was then called the Second Narrows, that is to say, the contraction of the lake where it approaches its outlet. Close on their left, ruddy in the warm sunrise, rose the vast bare face of Rogers Rock, whence a French advanced party, under Lengy and an officer named Trepizic, was watching their movements. Lord Howe, with Rogers and Bradstreet, went in whaleboats to reconnoitre the landing. At the place which the French called the Burn Camp, where Montcalm had embarked the summer before, they saw a detachment of the enemy too weak to oppose them. Their men landed and drove them off. At noon the whole army was on shore. Rogers, with a party of Rangers, was ordered forward to reconnoitre, and the troops were formed for the march. From this part of the shore a plain covered with forest stretched northwestward half a mile or more to the mountains behind which lay the valley of Trout Brook. In this plain the army began its march in four columns, with the intention of passing round the western bank of the river of the outlet, since the bridge over it had been destroyed. Rogers, with the provincial regiments of Fitch and Lyman, led the way, at some distance before the rest. The forest was extremely dense and heavy, and so obstructed with undergrowth that it was impossible to see more than a few yards in any direction, while the ground was encumbered with fallen trees in every stage of decay. The ranks were broken, and the men struggled in, as they could, in dampness and shade, under a canopy of moss that the sun could scarcely pierce. The difficulty increased when, after advancing about a mile, they came upon undulating and broken ground. They were now not far from the upper rapids of the outlet. The guides became bewildered in the maze of trunks and moss, the marching columns were confused, and fell in one upon the other. They were in the strange situation of an army lost in the woods. The advanced party of French under Lengy and Trepizic, about 350 in all, regulars and Canadians, had tried to retreat, but before they could do so, the whole English army had passed them, landed, and placed itself between them and their countrymen. They had no resource but to take to the woods. They seem to have climbed the steep gorge at the side of Rogers Rock and followed the Indian path that led to the valley of Trout Brook, thinking to descend it, and, by circling along the outskirts of the valley of Ticonderoga, reach Montcalm's camp at the sawmill. Lengy was used to bush hunting, but he too became perplexed in the blind intricacies of the forest. Towards the close of the day he and his men had come out from the valley of Trout Brook, and were near the junction of that stream with the river of the outlet, in a state of some anxiety, for they could see nothing but brown trunks and green boughs. Could any of them have climbed one of the great pines that here and there reared their shaggy spires high above the surrounding forest, they would have discovered where they were, but would have gained not the faintest knowledge of the enemy. Out of the woods in the right they would have seen a smoke rising from the burning huts of the French camp at the head of the portage, which Bourlamaque had set on fire and abandoned. At a mile or more in front, the sawmill at the falls might perhaps have been descried, and, by glimpses between the trees, the tents of the neighboring camp where Montcalm still lay with his main force. All the rest seemed lonely as the grave. Mountain and valley lay wrapped in primeval woods, and none could have dreamed that, not far distant, an army was groping its way, buried in foliage, no rumbling of wagons and artillery trains, for none were there, all silent but the cawing of some crow flapping his black wings over the sea of treetops. Lord Howe, with Major Israel Putnam and 200 rangers, was at the head of the principal column, which was a little in advance of the three others. Suddenly the challenge, "Qui vive?" rang sharply from the thickets in front. "Francais," was the reply. Lengy's men were not deceived, they fired out of the bushes. The shots were returned, a hot skirmish followed, and Lord Howe dropped dead, shot through the breast. All was confusion. The dull, vicious reports of musketry in thick woods, at first few and scattering, then in fierce and rapid volleys, reached the troops behind. They could hear, but see nothing. Already harassed and perplexed, they became perturbed. For all they knew, Montcalm's whole army was upon them. Nothing prevented a panic but the steadiness of the rangers, who maintained the fight alone till the rest came back to their senses. Rogers, with his reconnoitering party, and the regiments of Fitch and Lyman, were at no great distance in front. They all turned in hearing the musketry, and thus the French were caught between two fires. They fought with desperation. About 50 of them at length escaped, 148 were captured, and the rest killed or drowned in trying to cross the rapids. The loss of the English was small in numbers, but immeasurable in the death of Howe. "The fall of this noble and brave officer," says Rogers, "seemed to produce an almost general languor and consternation through the whole army." In Lord Howe, writes another contemporary, Major Thomas Mant, "the soul of General Abercrombie's army seemed to expire. From the unhappy moment the general was deprived of his advice, neither order nor discipline was observed, and a strange kind of infatuation usurped the place of resolution. The death of one man was the ruin of 15,000. The evil news was dispatched to Albany, and in 2 or 3 days the messenger who bore it passed the house of Mrs. Schuyler in the meadows above the town. In the afternoon, says her biographer, a man was seen coming from the north galloping violently without his hat. Pebram, as he was familiarly called, Colonel Schuyler's only surviving brother, was with her, and ran instantly to inquire, well knowing that he rode express. The man galloped on, crying out that Lord Howe was killed. The mind of our good aunt had been so engrossed by her anxiety and fears for the event impending, and so impressed with the merit and magnanimity of her favorite hero, that her wonted firmness sank under the stroke, and she broke out into bitter lamentations. This had such an effect in her friends and domestics that shrieks and sobs of anguish echoed through every part of the house. Quote, "The effect of the loss was seen at once. The army was needlessly kept under arms all night in the forest, and in the morning was ordered back to the landing, whence it came. Towards noon, however, Bradstreet was sent with a detachment of regulars and provincials to take possession of the sawmill at the falls, which Montcalm had abandoned the evening before. Bradstreet rebuilt the bridges destroyed by the retiring enemy, and sent word to his commander that the way was open in which Abercrombie again put his army in motion, reached the falls late in the afternoon, and occupied the deserted encampment of the French. Montcalm, with his main force, had held this position at the falls through most of the preceding day, doubtful, it seems, to the last, whether he should not make his final stand there. Bourlamaque was for doing so, but two old officers, Burns and Montguy, pointed out the danger that the English would occupy the neighboring heights, whereupon Montcalm at length resolved to fall back. The camp was broken up at 5 o'clock. Some of the troops embarked in bateaux, while others marched a mile and a half along the forest road, past the place where the battalion of Berry was still at work in the breastwork begun in the morning, and made their bivouac a little farther on, upon the cleared ground that surrounded the fort. The peninsula of Ticonderoga consists of a rocky plateau, with low grounds in each side, bordering Lake Champlain in the one hand, and the outlet of Lake George on the other. The fort stood near the end of the peninsula, which points towards the southeast. Thence, as one goes westward, the ground declines a little, and then slowly rises, till, about half a mile from the fort, it reaches its greatest elevation, and begins still more gradually to decline again. Thus a ridge is formed across the plateau between the steep declivities that sink to the low grounds on right and left. Some weeks before, a French officer named Hughes had suggested the defense of this ridge by means of an abattis. Montcalm approved his plan, and now, at the 11th hour, he resolved to make his stand here. The two engineers, Pontoroy and de Sandrouin, had already traced the outline of the works, and the soldiers of the battalion of Berry had made some progress in constructing them. At dawn of the 7th, while Abercrombie, fortunately for his enemy, was drawing his troops back to the landing place, the whole French army fell to their task. The regimental colors were planted along the line, and the officers, stripped to the shirt, took axe in hand and labored with their men. The trees that covered the ground were hewn down by thousands, the tops lopped off, and the trunks piled one upon another to form a massive breastwork. The line followed the top of the ridge, along which it zigzagged in such a manner that the whole front could be swept by flank fires of musketry and grape. Abercrombie describes the wall of logs as between 8 and 9 feet high, in which case there must have been a rude banquet, or platform to fire from, in the inner side. It was certainly so high that nothing could be seen over it but the crowns of the soldiers' heads. The upper tier was formed of single logs, in which notches were cut to serve as loopholes, and in some places sods and bags of sand were piled along the top, with narrow spaces to fire through. From the central part of the line the ground sloped away like a natural glacis, while at the sides, and especially in the left, it was undulating and broken. Over this whole space, to the distance of a musket shot from the works, the forest was cut down, and the trees left lying, where they fell among the stumps, Wicktops turned outwards, forming one vast abatis, which, as a Massachusetts officer says, looked like a forest laid flat by a hurricane. But the most formidable obstruction was immediately along the front of the breastwork, where the ground was covered with heavy boughs, overlapping and interlaced, with sharpened points bristling into the face of the assailant like the quills of a porcupine. As these works were all of wood, no vestige of them remains. The earthworks now shown to tourists, as the lines of Montcalm, are of later construction, and though in the same ground, are not on the same plan. Here, then, was a position which, if attacked in front with musketry alone, might be called impregnable. But would Abercrombie so attack it? He had several alternatives. He might attempt the flank and rear of his enemy by way of the low grounds in the right and left of the plateau, a movement which the precautions of Montcalm had made difficult, but not impossible. Or, instead of leaving his artillery idle in the strand of Lake George, he might bring it to the front and batter the breastwork, which, though impervious to musketry, was worthless against heavy cannon. Or he might do what Burgoyne did with success a score of years later, and plant a battery in the heights of Rattlesnake Hill, now called Mount Defiance, which commanded the position of the French, and whence the inside of their breastwork could be scoured with round shot from end to end. Or, while threatening the French front with a part of his army, he could march the rest a short distance through the woods in his left to the road which led from Ticonderoga to Crown Point, and which would soon have brought him to the place called 5 Mile Point, where Lake Champlain narrows to the width of an easy rifle shot, and where a battery of field pieces would have cut off all Montcalm's supplies and closed his only way of retreat. As the French were provisioned for but 8 days, their position would thus have been desperate. They plainly saw the danger, and Doyle declares that had the movement been made, their whole army must have surrendered. Montcalm had done what he could, but the danger of his position was inevitable and extreme. His hope lay in Abercrombie, and it was a hope well founded. The action of the English general answered the utmost wishes of his enemy. Abercrombie had been told by his prisoners that Montcalm had 6,000 men, and that 3,000 more were expected every hour. Therefore he was in haste to attack, before these succors could arrive. As was the general, so was the army. "I believe," writes an officer, "we were one and all infatuated by a notion of carrying every obstacle by a mere coup de mousquetry. Leadership perished with Lord Howe, and nothing was left but blind, headlong valor. Clerk, chief engineer, was sent to reconnoitre the French works from Mount Defiance, and came back with the report that, to judge from what he could see, they might be carried by assault." Then, without waiting to bring up his cannon, Abercrombie prepared to storm the lines. The French finished their breastwork and abattis in the evening of the 7th, encamped behind them, slung their kettles, and rested after their heavy toil. Levi's had not yet appeared, but at twilight one of his officers, Captain Bouchet, arrived with 300 regulars, and announced that his commander would come before morning with 100 more. The reinforcement, though small, was welcome, and Levi's was a host in himself. Bouchet was told that the army was half a mile off. Thither he repaired, made his report to Montcalm, and looked with amazement at the prodigious amount of work accomplished in one day. Levi's himself arrived in the course of the night, and approved the arrangement of the troops. They lay behind their lines till daybreak, then the drums beat, and they formed in order of battle. The battalions of Lasserre and Languedoc were posted in the left, under Bourlamaque, The 1st Battalion of Berry, with that of Royal Roussillon in the center, under Montcalm, and those of Lorraine, Bern, and Guienne in the right, under Levis. A detachment of volunteers occupied the low grounds between the breastwork and the outlet of Lake George, while, at the foot of the declivity in the side towards Lake Champlain, were stationed 450 colony regulars and Canadians, behind an abattis which they had made for themselves, and as they were covered by the cannon of the fort, there was some hope that they would check any flank movement which the English might attempt on that side. Their posts being thus assigned, the men fell to work again to strengthen their defenses. Including those who came with Levi's, the total force of effective soldiers was now 3,600. Soon after 9 o'clock, a distant and harmless fire of small arms began on the slopes of Mount Defiance. It came from a party of Indians who had just arrived with Sir William Johnson, and who, after amusing themselves in this manner for a time, remained for the rest of the day safe spectators of the fight. The soldiers worked undisturbed till noon, when volleys of musketry were heard from the forest in front. It was the English light troops driving in the French pickets. A cannon was fired, as a signal to drop tools and form for battle. The white uniforms lined the breastwork in a triple row, with the grenadiers behind them as a reserve, and the 2nd Battalion of Berry watching the flanks and rear. Meanwhile, the English army had moved forward from its camp by the sawmill. First came the Rangers, the light infantry, and Bradstreet's armed boatmen, who, emerging into the open space, began a spattering fire. Some of the provincial troops followed, extending from left to right, and opening fire in turn. Then the regulars, who had formed in columns of attack under cover of the forest, advanced their solid red masses into the sunlight, and passing through the intervals between the provincial regiments, pushed forward to the assault. Across the rough ground, with its maze of fallen trees whose leaves hung withering in the July sun, they could see the top of the breastwork, but not the men behind it, when, in an instant, all the line was obscured by a gush of smoke, a crash of exploding firearms tore the air, and grape shot and musket balls swept the whole space like a tempest. "A damnable fire," says an officer who heard them screaming about his ears. The English had been ordered to carry the works with a bayonet, but their ranks were broken by the obstructions through which they struggled in vain to force their way, and they soon began to fire in turn. The storm raged in full fury for an hour. The assailants pushed close to the breastwork, but there they were stopped by the bristling mass of sharpened branches, which they could not pass under the murderous crossfires that swept them from front and flank. At length they fell back, exclaiming that the works were impregnable. Abercrombie, who was at the sawmill, a mile and a half in the rear, sent orders to attack again, and again they came on as before. The scene was frightful. Masses of infuriated men who could not go forward and would not go back, straining for an enemy they could not reach, and firing on an enemy they could not see, caught in the entanglement of fallen trees, tripped by briars, stumbling over logs, peering through boughs, shouting, yelling, cursing, and pelted all the while with bullets that killed them by scores, stretched them on the ground, or hung them on jagged branches in strange attitudes of death. The provincials supported the regulars with spirit, and some of them forced their way to the foot of the wooden wall. The French fought with the intrepid gaiety of their nation, and shouts of "Vive le roi!" and "Vive notre général!" mingled with the din of musketry. Montcalm, with his coat off, for the day was hot, directed the defense of the center, and repaired to any part of the line where the danger for the time seemed greatest. He is warm in praise of his enemy, and declares that between 1 and 7 o'clock they attacked him 6 successive times. Early in the action, Abercrombie tried to turn the French left by sending 20 bateaux, filled with troops, down the outlet of Lake George. They were met by the fire of the volunteers stationed to defend the low grounds in that side, and, still advancing, came within range of the cannon of the fort, which sank 2 of them and drove back the rest. A curious incident happened during one of the attacks. De Bassignac, a captain in the battalion of Royal Roussillon, tied his handkerchief to the end of a musket and waved it over the breastwork in defiance. The English mistook it for a sign of surrender, and came forward with all possible speed, holding their muskets crossed over their heads in both hands, and crying quarter. The French made the same mistake, and thinking that their enemies were giving themselves up as prisoners, ceased firing, and mounted in the top of the breastwork to receive them. Captain Paget, astonished, as he says, to see them perched there, looked out to learn the cause, and saw that the enemy meant anything but surrender. Whereupon he shouted with all his might, "Tires! Tires! Ne voyez vous pas que ces gens là ont vu en l'air?" The soldiers, still standing on the breastwork, instantly gave the English a volley, which killed some of them, and sent back the rest discomfited. This was set to the account of Gallic treachery. "Another deceit the enemy put upon us," says a military letter writer. "They raised their heads above the breastwork, which our people fired at, they having loopholes to fire through, and being covered by the sods, we did them little damage, except shooting their heads to pieces." In one of the last assaults, a soldier of the Rhode Island Regiment, William Smith, managed to get through all obstructions and ensconce himself close under the breastwork, where in the confusion he remained for a time unnoticed, improving his advantages meanwhile by shooting several Frenchmen. Being at length observed, a soldier fired vertically down upon him and wounded him severely, but not enough to prevent his springing up, striking at one of his enemies over the top of the wall, and braining him with his hatchet. A British officer who saw the feat, and was struck by the reckless daring of the man, ordered 2 regulars to bring him off, which, covered by a brisk fire of musketry, they succeeded in doing. A letter from the camp 2 or 3 weeks later reports him, as in a fair way to recover, being, says the writer, much braced and invigorated by his anger against the French, in whom he was swearing to have his revenge. Toward 5 o'clock 2 English columns joined in a most determined assault on the extreme right of the French, defended by the battalions of Guienne and Verdun. The danger for a time was imminent. Montcalm hastened to the spot with the reserves. The assailants hewed their way to the foot of the breastwork, and though again and again repulsed, they again and again renewed the attack. The Highlanders fought with stubborn and unconquerable fury. "Even those who were mortally wounded," writes one of their lieutenants, "cried to their companions not to lose a thought upon them, but to follow their officers and mind the honor of their country." Their ardor was such that it was difficult to bring them off. Their major, Campbell of Inverroch, found his foreboding true. He received a mortal shot, and his clansmen bore him from the field. 25 of their officers were killed or wounded, and half the men fell under the deadly fire that poured from the loopholes. Captain John Campbell and a few followers tore their way through the abattis, climbed the breastwork, leaped down among the French, and were bayoneted there. As the colony troops and Canadians in the low ground were left undisturbed, Levis sent them an order to make a sortie and attack the left flank of the charging columns. They accordingly posted themselves among the trees along the declivity, and fired upwards at the enemy, who presently shifted their position to the right, out of the line of shot. The assault still continued, but in vain, and at 6 there was another effort, equally fruitless. From this time till 7:30 a lingering fight was kept up by the Rangers and other provincials, firing from the edge of the woods and from behind the stumps, bushes, and fallen trees in front of the lines. Its only objects were to cover their comrades, who were collecting and bringing off the wounded, and to protect the retreat of the regulars, who fell back in disorder to the falls. As twilight came on, the last combatant withdrew, and none were left but the dead. Abercrombie had lost in killed, wounded, and missing, 1,944 officers and men. The loss of the French, not counting that of Lengy's detachment, was 377. Orlamac was dangerously wounded, Bougainville slightly, and the head of Levi's was twice shot through. Montcalm, with a mighty load lifted from his soul, passed along the lines, and gave the tired soldiers the thanks they nobly deserved. Beer, wine, and food were served out to them, and they bivouacked for the night in the level ground between the breastwork and the fort. The enemy had met a terrible rebuff, yet the danger was not over. Abercrombie still had more than 13,000 men, and he might renew the attack with cannon. But, in the morning of the 9th, a band of volunteers who had gone out to watch him brought back the report that he was in full retreat. The sawmill at the falls was on fire, and the last English soldier was gone. In the morning of the 10th, Levi's, with a strong detachment, followed the road to the landing place, and found signs that a panic had overtaken the defeated troops. They had left behind several hundred barrels of provisions and a large quantity of baggage, while in a marshy place that they had crossed was found a considerable number of their shoes, which had stuck in the mud, and which they had not stopped to recover. They had embarked on the morning after the battle, and retreated to the head of the lake in a disorder and dejection woefully contrasted with the pomp of their advance. A gallant army was sacrificed by the blunders of its chief. Montcalm announced his victory to his wife in a strain of exaggeration that marks the exaltation of his mind. Without Indians, almost without Canadians or colony troops, I had only 400, alone with Levi's and Borlamac and the troops of the line, 3,100 fighting men. I have beaten an army of 25,000. They repassed the lake precipitately, with a loss of at least 5,000. This glorious day does infinite honor to the valor of our battalions. I have no time to write more. I am well, my dearest, and I embrace you. And he wrote to his friend Doriel, the army, the too small army of the king, has beaten the enemy. What a day for France! If I had had 200 Indians to send out at the head of 1,000 picked men under the Chevalier de Levi's, not many would have escaped. Ah, my dear Doriel, what soldiers are ours! I never saw the like. Why were they not at Louisbourg? In the moral of his victory he caused a great cross to be planted in the battlefield, inscribed with these lines, composed by the soldier scholar himself. Quid dux? Quid miles? Quid strata and gentulina? En signum. En victor. Deus hic, Deus ex triumphat. Soldier and chief and rampart strength or not, behold the conquering cross! 'Tis God the triumph wrought. Quote.